verse.
We're doing the book of Shmuel, and we're up to what's called the third chapter, the end. Shmuel had gotten his first prophecy the night before. Eli tells him, "Tell me what you see." And Shmuel is supposed to tell him, but he is very reticent. He's scared. He's going to tell Eli that his two sons will die. So Eli tells him, "I wish you, Hashem should continue doing this for you. You should continue having prophecy. Don't hide anything from me." And Shmuel tells him, and Eli, in his tremendous piety, says, "Hashem is the merciful one. He should do what's good in his eyes. The man just heard his two sons will die on the same day, and he accepts it. Hashem is good. Whatever he sees fit, he should do." So Eli tries and is unsuccessful in rebuking his children. And we encounter over here a concept that says that more people had prophecy together with Shmuel. So one of the things we have to know is that we affect the people around us. It's a constant. If you show up 10 minutes early for davening, so slowly you start giving the feeling in shul that it's a good thing to show up before davening. Your roommates feel it. The people who daven next to you feel it. If you stay after davening to learn for 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, people start feeling bad leaving at the end of davening because, hey, wouldn't it be, am I in such a rush or could I really stay 5 minutes to learn? There are little things we can do that change the atmosphere. And it could be on a bus. I was on a bus this morning and a bunch of youngsters got on the bus and they were very rowdy. And suddenly one goes to the others, he goes, "There's a seat in the back." So the others go, "You can go." And he goes, "No, you don't get it. There's a seat in the back." So the other guys go, you can push through and get it." He says, "No, I didn't mean for us. There's an old man up there. Can you please tell him there's a seat in the back?" Suddenly everyone looks at the whole bus ride differently. He wasn't talking about himself. He was talking about the old man. So they pass the word up to the old man and they say, "You know, there's a seat in the back." So the old man looks back at the kids and he says to them, "If I go sit back there, I will get to my destination later. If I stay up here, then I'll get there first." It was a joke, yeah. They both changed the atmosphere on the bus. When we do things, we affect other people. Chazal say it works on levels that we don't even realize. When Shmuel gets prophecy, other people can attain prophecy too. There's a story, it's folklore, I don't know if it's true, but there's the following story. That Rav Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, was up all night one night on a line in Gemara that he couldn't figure out. He had a question and he tried to figure out the answer, and then he had a question on that answer and tried to figure out the answer on that, and he spends the whole night going back and forth, and finally, just before the crack of dawn, he figures out the answer. He writes it down and he goes to shul and he's very happy. So he goes to shul and they haven't yet started davening, and there's a kid sitting in the back before davening learning, and he hears the kid. And the kid is learning the same Gemara he learned all night. And the kid reaches the line that Rav Yosef Karo was stuck on. And the kid reads the line, and then he asks the question. And he sits there and thinks for a second, and he gives Rav Yosef Karo's first answer. So Rav Yosef Karo smiles to himself. He says, "Yeah, I thought that was right too." And then the kid quickly says, "No, that doesn't work." And he refutes it with Rav Yosef Karo's refute. So Rav Yosef Karo says, "Huh?" And a second later, the kid comes back with the second answer. And then the refutation. And then the third answer. And then the refutation. And finally the fourth answer. And he's got it right. And he goes, "Okay, that's pshat in the Gemara." And then he goes on. And Rav Yosef Karo looks at the kid and he says, "I stayed up all night. And he just did that in 1 minute. And he went to daven and he felt terrible." So he finished his davening. Now this is important to know. Sometimes we feel terrible because we see other people around us. It's important to know that the giants of Jewish history also had moments where they felt terrible. When Moshe Rabbeinu saw Rabbi Akiva, he said, "Ribbono Shel Olam, why are you giving the Torah through me? He knows stuff I don't know. He was able to figure out stuff I couldn't figure out, Rabbi Akiva." So Moshe Rabbeinu had a moment where he felt like, what am I worth? right? When Hashem teaches Moshe Rabbeinu how to build the menorah, so the Medrash says Hashem taught it to him. He said, I'm not getting it. Hashem taught it to him again. He says, okay, I got it. He went down the mountain and said, wait, I forgot. I didn't get it. Goes back up and says, Rabbon Shalom, I don't remember. Could you explain it to me again? Rabbon Shalom explains it to him again. He goes down the mountain and he says, wait, I lost it again. He goes back up the mountain. He says, Rabbon Shalom, I know you explained it to me, but I'm not getting it. Could you explain to me a third time? Rabbon Shalom explains it to him a third time. He goes down the mountain, says the Medrash Rabbah, and says, I don't get it. He can't build the menorah. He comes back and says, Rabbon Shalom, I know you explained to me three times, but I still don't get it. I thought I had it, but when I got off the mountain, I didn't. And the Rabbon Shalom said, don't worry, go to Bezalel. So Bezalel, who's 12 or 13 years old, Moshe goes over to him and he knows how to do it. So Moshe looks at him and says, wait, Hashem taught me and I couldn't get it. And you got it? Ah, so we have different roles in this world. That means you could be Moshe Rabbeinu, but you're not going to be so good in building a Mishkan. Bezalel can have greater insight and understanding and know how to do it, and Moshe could not. So, again, coming back to this idea, we all encounter moments where we look and say, wait a second, what am I worth? Look at this other person. And then we have to remind ourselves, I have my job. But when I do my job, I affect the people around me. And so we learned this concept in the Drashot Aran, and here we see it almost overtly. This idea that when Shmuel gets prophecy, suddenly people around them can get prophecy too. And this is like osmosis. When a person grows spiritually, it affects people around them without them even talking to him. It's like you open the gates. Wait, end of the story. Rabbi Yosef Karo goes home to catch up on sleep. He was up all night. He's pretty upset. He goes to sleep. And in a dream, they tell him, don't feel bad. You learned it and you worked hard. And because you worked hard, you made that Torah available to the world. Now even a kid could access that Torah. Before you worked on it, no one could access it. You worked all night on it. Now even a child that learns the Gemara will be able to access it. You brought that part of Torah down to the world. So yeah, you see the kid can do it easily. That's thanks to you. Don't feel bad. So that's Shmuel opens the gates of prophecy. Until Shmuel, it says Dvar Hashem, the word of Hashem was scarce. After Shmuel attained prophecy, Vayosef Hashem Leiro, Hashem started appearing by more people. More people were attaining prophecy throughout Shiloh. Yes. Who said he wasn't? Because that prophecy he was supposed to get through messenger. So Shmuel is the known prophet. The Jewish people go to battle Plishtim, and the first battle they lose. They lose 4,000 men. And the elders say, why have we lost today? Let's take with us the ark. And so they bring the ark. And when they bring the ark, the two sons of Eli come with the ark, and everyone rejoices that the ark has come to their camp, and now they're going to win. And when the Philistines hear this, they get disheartened. They say, how are we going to succeed? This is the awesome God that beat the Egyptians. We have to strengthen ourselves, because otherwise we're going to be slaves like they weren't slaves to us until now. And so they fought. And this was Hashem's intention. Am Yisrael loses this battle. 30,000 infantrymen fall. And Goliath runs up to the ark. And the two sons of Eli are standing there guarding the ark, and he slays both of them. Goliath kills Hophni and Pinchas on the spot. And then he opens up the ark, and he takes out the two tablets. The two tablets that Hashem made. The two luchos. And there's a young soldier there from the tribe of Binyamin. His name is Shaul ben Kish. Shaul is very tall. Shaul runs up to Goliath. No, you don't. And he grabs the luchos from his hands and runs. And he doesn't stop running. And he can stand up to Goliath and grab it out of his hands. And he runs and he runs and he runs until he reaches Shiloh. And when he reaches Shiloh, he tells the people, we lost. We lost the war. And the people start weeping. They're in big trouble. The Philistines are headed to Shiloh. Their next stop is going to be to destroy Shiloh, the area that was the temple of Hashem. And Eli, who can't see well anymore, is sitting waiting to hear what happened. He's sitting by the gate. He's all worried. And Shaul runs up to him and he says, "Am Yisrael lost the war, and we lost many people, and your two sons died, Hophni and Pinchas, and the ark, the Aron, was captured by the Philistines." And when he said that the Aron was captured, not over his two sons dying, over the Aron being captured, Eli collapses, he falls back, he breaks his neck and passes away after 40 years of leading the Jewish people. His daughter-in-law, Pinchas' wife, she has a delivery that's out of control. Now, I'm going to tell you something just you guys have to know as future parents, Be'ezat Hashem, and you have to figure out how to not say this but get the message across to your wife. There's a rule in delivery. When you're in control, then the midwife can work with you. When you yell and say, I can't, and then you go panic, and you yell your head off and you're in panic mode, at that moment the delivery becomes dangerous. Why? Because the way the body contracts, there are moments where if you push, you could tear the whole underside open. And there have been women who have done that. They have torn themselves to the point where all the apertures there were slit. They slit one into the other. They just tore themselves open. There's a science, there's a skill to when to push and when not to push. When the midwife can position and how the positioning of the head is, and when it's wrong to push. And a woman who's not participating, who's not doing what the midwife tells her, can harm herself for life. So in our day and age, they do surgery, they do stitching, and even that's not simple, because very often the stitching gets infected. Sometimes, don't tell your wives this, but they mess up on the stitching and things aren't aligned properly, and then the skin can be painful for the rest of their life down there. It's not a joke, this stitching business. Most of the time they get it right, but it's not a joke. A woman has to participate with them. So you can't tell your wives this, meaning you can't be there telling your wife, "Honey, stay in control. Believe me, you don't want to lose control." That's not the way. You're supposed to be supportive. She's in the most intense pain. You're supposed to tell her, "You're doing a great job. Good for you. I'm so proud of you. You're amazing," right? You have to give her all the kvach in the world. But bear in mind, in your prep, it is worthwhile to put her in the know. Somewhere slip it in that she should know that the more she's in control, the safer it is for her, the less pain she'll be in. And I know children where the baby was born with the umbilical cord wrapped around their neck. And the midwife was there. I heard this from the midwife herself. She said, "We have to do C-section," she whispers to the midwife next to her. "The baby has the umbilical cord around his neck." So the baby's almost out. The woman went through all of labor, but now they see that the umbilical cord's around the neck. And the older midwife said to her, she said, "This lady's in control. She's working with us. We can be done in 30 seconds. The baby will be safe." And the midwives told me, if it would be a woman who was not working with them, then at the end of delivery, it would have been a C-section. It was a woman that was working with them. She saved herself a C-section. Finished the delivery, baby's safe and sound, everything's great. Pinchas's wife lost control. She heard we lost the battle. She heard her husband was dead. All of that didn't make her lose control. She heard the Aron was taken. She lost it. At that moment, she couldn't control her delivery anymore, and she tore herself to death, literally. She tore herself to the point where she bled and they couldn't stop the bleeding and she died. And during childbirth, the child lived. She gave the child a very difficult name. She called him Ichavod, lack of honor. She said, "Israel lost its honor. The ark was taken from us." And she died at childbirth. So the child was born a total orphan. He lost his father prior to childbirth. He lost his mother at childbirth. We know two other people in Jewish history this happened to. Esther. Esther's father died in utero, and her mother died at childbirth. And the Amora in Talmud, Abaye. Abaye also was born a total orphan. His father died in utero, his mother died at childbirth. He was raised by his uncle, Rabbi Bar Nachmani. Back to Navi. So, the Philistines take the ark. And so they want to show that they won the war. So they bring it to their temple of Dagon. Dagon is half man, half fish. And they place it before Dagon as though, look, you've been captured by our God. They wake up the next morning. This is in the city of Ashdod. Ashdod is on the western side of Israel, near the Mediterranean. That's the whole area, what they call today the Gaza Strip. That's the area that was, during much of Jewish history, there were Philistines there. Not to be confused with the Palestinians, who just took that name. But there were Philistines there. So Ashdod was a Philistine city. And they come into their temple and they find their idol bowing before the Aron. They say, whoa, must be some imbalance here. We'll just set him back on his pedestal. Everything will be all right. They don't get the hint. They set him on the pedestal. The next morning they come back and they find him bowing, and his head and hands are chopped off and they're hacked off, and they're placed on the doorpost, on the doorstep entering their temple. So they say, ooh, so the doorstep must be a holy place. From that day onward, they don't step on the doorpost. You have to skip over the doorpost to enter. But they don't get the hint. So the people of Ashdod start having terrible hemorrhoids, and they start being attacked by rats and mice, and they start having their innards coming out, and they have terrible illnesses that affect their ability to defecate. And when they see how ill they've become, so they send to the elders of the Philistines, and they say, what are we supposed to do? They say, send them to the Philistine city of Gat. So they send them to Gat, and in the city of Gat, same thing happens. People start going to the bathroom and seeing their innards starting to pour out in the bathroom. Their lower intestines are withering away. And they'd go to the bathroom and find rats were coming in and biting out their lower apertures. This was a Turkish invention, by the way. Or at least the Turks thought they'd invent it. One of the ways of torture was they take a nail and put it through the lower aperture. And once you break the muscle, a person can't contain himself. Once you break that muscle, the lower opening where a person retains himself from defecating. So this was a Turkish torture. The Turks, when they capture someone, their army would take him and put a nail through his lower aperture, and then the person would always make in his pants. This was like for the rest of their life. They lost that muscle. The person couldn't control themselves. So this is what happened to the people in Gat. The rats would come and bite out the muscle, the lower muscle, and suddenly that's it. They lost their ability to contain themselves. So they weren't too happy about this. So they quickly send the ark to Ekron. And when the ark comes to Ekron, so the people of Ekron say, what are you doing to me? You want to kill us? We don't want the ark by us. So they call the elders, and the elders say, okay, send them back. Send them with, everyone's scared of death over here, but we're going to do a test. It's been 7 months. We're going to do a test. We're going to send them back with gifts, and we're going to bind a wagon with two young calves, tie their mother behind, and see if the calves lead the wagon back to Israel, then you know. But make gold figurines of the body parts that were wounded, and the mice or rats, whatever they were, that were being destructive, and you put them as offerings with the ark, and you send it back. So the elders say, don't be hard-hearted like the Egyptians. There's no reason to suffer that kind of destruction. Let's get the hint. So that's what they do. They send it back, and the ark goes up the border to Beit Shemesh, which if you look at a map, I don't have a map here with me, but Beit Shemesh is parallel to the northern. That's the missiles they were shooting at us from Gaza reached Beit Shemesh. I think that was the outskirts of Beit Shemesh were hit by the missiles from Gaza. You know, you hear about Sderot, you hear about the cities that are right near Gaza. But the truth is, it's a straight line to Beit Shemesh. So I don't know if the ancient Beit Shemesh was exactly where our Beit Shemesh is, but the cows seemed like they were singing as they went a straight path to Beit Shemesh. The people of Beit Shemesh are in the middle of harvesting. They see the ark, and they're very happy, and they say, ooh, Ribono Shel Olam. why'd you get upset at us that you left us? And who appeased you that you came back? So they were being disrespectful to the ark when it came back. They're making fun. And they continued bare-chested harvesting and bowing to the ark. So in the house of Yoshua in Beit Shemesh, they chop up the wagon and they sacrifice the cows. The Levites take down the ark, but the people are being disrespectful. So when the people are being disrespectful, 5,070 men die, and the whole high court dies. And so the nation feels like the leaders of Beit Shemesh were all killed. So the people of Beit Shemesh say, obviously we don't know how to respect the ark. We can't handle the ark by us any better. Look, the Philistines suffered, we suffered. So they send word to Kiryat Yarim, which they say is somewhere near Telstone, just outside Yerushalayim, and they send the ark there. And the ark comes to the house of a man named Avinadav, and Avinadav establishes his son the Kohen to serve before the ark every day, and he is blessed. Every daughter and daughter-in-law of his gives birth 9 months later to six kids. That's what it says in Chronicles in Divrei Hayamim, that his family boomed that year. Now, I don't know why that's a blessing, but I guess it is. Maybe if you have enough money to have, if you have enough money to have enough wet nurses and stuff. You know how hard it is to handle two babies? I was telling my kids the Parsha story this Shabbos. I was trying to describe to them how Rivka would nurse two babies at the same time. It's hard to raise twins. You could have a lot of servants. I guess it's easier. But I guess that's how they handled six kids for each daughter and daughter-in-law. I mean, you never have a night. In the first 6 months, there's always one child crying. What?
How many daughters and daughters?
I don't remember, six or seven. It says in Divrei Hayamim. I don't remember the number. It's a lot. Yeah, it means I had another 36 babies in the house. It's a blessing down the road, but I'm saying the first 5 years, that's really hard, yeah. What they say is that it's not six times as hard as raising one kid. I don't know. I never had that blessing. They say twins are not doubly hard, a single baby. They're not. That's what they say. I don't know. You don't have six hands. You need a lot of servants. I'm saying, how do you raise six kids? I don't know. Triplets isn't six. Triplets I could still fathom. Triplets I can hear. Okay. I don't know. Right. There are three or four opinions in the Gemara and in the Alkot Shimoni as to what exactly happened here. Look it up and then we'll talk.
Where can I find that?
The Alkot Shimoni on this pasuk. Which ark did they take out? I didn't go into it this year. Previous years we went into it. This year I want to cover a little more ground. Okay, so we got 2 minutes left. So Avinadav is in front of the ark, and it's been 20 years, and Am Yisrael has this massive tshuva movement. 20 years have passed since they lost the ark, and Shmuel gathers the people and he says, you want to do real tshuva? You have to remove the idols from your midst. And so the Jews do that. And then Shmuel says, okay, so now I'm going to pray for you. And they unite, they fast, they do tshuva, and they're ready for war with the Philistines. So the Philistines show up, and Am Yisrael's scared. And they tell Shmuel, daven for us. And so Shmuel offers a sacrifice, one young goat, and he prays for them. And as he's praying, the Philistines attack. And this is where we'll pick up, is on Shem next week.